Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Good afternoon, everyone. A very, very sunny afternoon. So it's been quite the week. We've had, of course, the local elections. Now, the Tories took a battering. I think that's important to say. It was on the worse end of what they privately predicted, despite attempts in the Telegraph to suggest they were on course to lose many more hundreds of seats than they actually did. That was never going to happen. But they still took an absolute battering. Question is, did Labour make enough progress to be comfortable, for example, forming at least a minority government in the event of a hung parliament, let alone a majority? But it isn't all, of course, it hasn't all been about the local elections. On the day of the local election results coming through, the so-called Beergate scandal, which I have to say people like myself dismissed out of hand, appeared to engulf the Labour leadership. So we're going to be talking about the latest on that, the latest revelations. What does it all mean? Is Keir Starmer in a lot of trouble? But more broadly, does he have a shot at becoming Labour leader? We'll talk about the kind of internal wranglings of the Labour Party. That's what we like to do on the left. So later on, we'll be joined by Michael Walker from Navarra and, of course, the journalist Paul Mason to offer, I think, different perspectives on what next for the Labour Party. Now, what I'm going to do is bring in first, because we don't have him for long, and we're very lucky to have him, the brilliant, of course, I can't say sociologist, can I, John? So John Curtis, how do I pronounce sociologist? I can't do it.
It's sophologist. It's why you need to have had an education in the classics, and then it's straightforward. But Stephos Ebel in Greek.
I'm not the first person to tell myself to get a bit more educated, and you won't be the last. John, obviously, very familiar on our screens during every election period in particular. Let's just have a look quickly at where things now stand, because I saw your analysis throughout the night on the local elections, as I'm sure many people did. So we can see here the change in net change for councillors for the Conservatives, minus 491. That is a battering, I would say. Labour up 115, Lib Dems up 222, Independents up 44, SNP up 22, Plaid have gone down 6. Oh, well, that's interesting in itself. The Green Party have gone up 85. And the projected share, according to Thrasher here, Labour 35%, Tories 33%. So firstly, George, just firstly, how bad are things for the Tories? How bad was that in terms of the loss of seats for the Conservatives?
Well, I think the way I would put it is that the Conservatives are now in choppy electoral waters. And they are so for the first time in this parliament. Indeed, perhaps it's been pretty remarkable that, certainly as compared with the records of most governments, that it's taken as long as this for it to happen. We might even feel that at least there's a risk of a gale coming down the track for them, but they're not as yet at least in the teeth of a hurricane. I mean, certainly, neither the opinion polls nor these local election results suggest that this government is in as much trouble as John Major's government was for quite a few years before 1997. But, of course, the reason why we are interested in this is that because the government has been ahead for so long in this parliament, and that certainly if you compare this result with previous local elections, well, it's not as bad for the Conservatives as 2019, when Theresa May was desperately trying and failing to get her party's endorsement of the Brexit agreement that she'd reached with the European Union. But if you leave that to one side, it is actually the worst local election performance by the Conservatives since before the EU referendum. And to that extent, at least, is a reminder that the delivery of Brexit on its own is not necessarily going to deliver the Conservatives' victory in the next election. In other words, those people who voted for the Conservatives in 2019, most of them Leave voters. Now that Brexit's been delivered, will be concerned about other things ranging from the cost of living crisis to Partygate. And again, the opinion polls shown pretty consistently throughout this parliament that actually, while the what was left of the Remain element of the Tory coalition has proved to be remarkably loyal, it's the Leave element of the Conservative coalition that's been going up and down as the party's popularity in the polls has gone up and down, and that basically now, whereas you know in 2019 the Conservatives commanded the Leave vote and Labour was sharing the Remain vote with the Liberal Democrats and the SNP, now the proportion of Leave voters who say they're going to vote for the Conservatives in another election is barely any higher than the proportion of Remain voters who say they're going to vote Labour. And for as long as that persists, then at least there is a fair electoral competition between the two largest parties.
In terms of Labour, so obviously you're comparing with 2018 when the equivalent local elections took place. What would you say about Labour's performance compared to 4 years ago?
The answer is that both we and Mornings and Thrasher basically say it's more or less the same. I think we said it was 35 and it was 35 4 years ago. But if you get into the decimal points, then Labour's vote is actually slightly down. It's particularly down in the north of England as compared with 4 years ago. Labour's strategy, I think, on election night was basically say, well, there's a whole litany of pretty poor election results that we could say we would like to compare ourselves with. But so why don't we just take the one that was the worst one, which was the December 2019 general election, and kind of say, well, we think we're probably going to do better than that. So we'll be guaranteed to be able to support the claim that we've made progress. I think many of us, however, felt that this wasn't really the test that Labour should be passing. After all, Sir Keir Starmer is essentially wanting to argue that the Labour Party now, under his leadership, is able to reach parts of the electorate that it wasn't able to reach under Jeremy Corbyn. And it so happened that the 2018 local elections were Jeremy Corbyn's, or the best performance by Labour under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. So therefore, what Labour really needed to do was to demonstrate that they were doing better than they were 4 years ago. And it basically, the evidence is that you know they certainly weren't doing better, and at the margin, they might have been doing slightly worse. So to that extent, at least, the Labour Party cannot claim at the moment to have reached a new height. And the truth is, you know, the seat gains that Labour have made are much more of a reflection of the decline in Conservative support than it is a rise in Labour support. You have to remember, with a single member plurality system, you can gain seats even if you don't make any progress, simply if your opponents go down. And the same basically is also true in Scotland. Why is Labour second? Well, yes, its vote's up by 2 points as compared with 2017, but that was a pretty dire performance in itself. It's the 5-6 point drop in the Conservative vote north of the border that explains why Labour is second. And the gap between the SNP and Labour in these local elections is exactly what it was 5 years ago. So I think what one has to say, which has been, you know, the message of the opinion polls, is that yes, Labour, you know, certainly is ahead. Again, largely because of the problems of the Conservatives rather than because of any great enthusiasm for the Labour Party. If there were to be a general election now, we would probably be having some kind of hung parliament in which Labour would have to negotiate the shoals of trying to do a deal with Liberal Democrats and or the SNP. But that, you know, the prospect of a Labour overall majority is still something that looks to be quite a distant prospect, and the party has to generate considerably more support than it's got at the moment before that looks in any way like a likely prospect.
What do you think about in terms of the Liberal Democrats' performance? Is that a genuine revival, and could that be helpful for Labour in that there are certain seats, of course, which would help Labour.
I mean, obviously, of course, it's somewhat difficult to tell, but if we leave aside 2019 local elections, which, again, as we said earlier, took place when Theresa May was in real trouble, and you know, the Liberal Democrats went on to be second in the European elections just 3 weeks later. Now, this year's is as good as that, more or less, but there isn't any other set of local elections that approximates that. So if we say that, you know, 2019 was the product of the Brexit difficulties and the Liberal Democrats was picking up only vote Labour, but were at that stage upset that Labour was in favour of the second referendum. So if we leave that aside, this is actually the best set of local election results for the Liberal Democrats since 2010, since they entered the coalition with the Conservatives. So together with the North Shropshire by-election, perhaps the Liberal Democrats are regaining their role as the party of protest, and particularly the party of protest in the middle of a conservative administration. And that certainly that progress was primarily in rural areas, you know, not all of them by any means leave voting areas, particularly in the south of England. And certainly if you start looking at the detailed ward results, it is very clear that the best Liberal Democrat advances occurred in places where they were starting off second to the Conservatives. That's true, even if you compare the results with last year, let alone 2018. And yes, it's Labour that's being squeezed. So not directly helpful to Labour, but insofar as if indeed voters in Liberal Democrat constituencies, where, you know, constituents of the Liberal Democrats are second, do indeed start voting tactically for the Democrats, that does reduce the chances of the Conservatives getting an overall majority. And of course, there are absolutely two crucial things one needs to understand about the sophology of the next general election. Number one is the electoral system will make it more difficult for Labour to get an overall majority than the Conservatives. But the second crucial thing you have to understand is the Conservatives do not have any friends in the House of Commons. There probably isn't any of the other political parties, including the DUP, who would now be willing to allow the Conservatives to sustain a minority administration. That basically means once the Conservatives are below 320, the ball would be in Labour's court, even if they've got many fewer seats than the Conservatives. The question is, and the crucial question that will face the Labour Party is, will it be willing to face the price that it would have to pay in order to sustain a minority administration? Now, there are basically two prices that he's likely to face. The first is doing something about proportional representation. That will be the Liberal Democrat price. And the other will be some kind of referendum on Scotland's constitutional future, which will be the SNP's price. Now, I guess that of the two, maybe the Liberal Democrat price will be more acceptable, because we certainly know there are plenty of people inside the Labour Party who are in favour of proportional representation. But that's probably the direction in which we would be going if there were to be a hung parliament. And, you know, of course, Sir Keir Starmer certainly say repeatedly no chance of a deal with the SNP. He will deny there's going to be any kind of pact with Liberal Democrats. But I will just remind people, just remember what David Cameron said before the 2010 general election. It will be an absolute disaster, chaos, if there is a hung parliament. Meanwhile, what was going on? Oliver Letwin, his policy guru, was reading the Liberal Democrat manifesto in great deal and preparing for coalition negotiations. And I think one you have to recognize that when party leaders are faced with the choice of becoming prime minister or losing the leadership of their party, they tend to prefer to become prime minister.
Last two questions, let you go. The Green Party. What do we make of that?
Well, the Greens have been making modest but discernible progress in the opinion polls. It's not the best Green performance ever. Again, 2019 was somewhat better for them. And the gains reflect, however, the fact that they're 4 points up on where they were in 2018. So again, always you have to remember we're looking at 2018. So they'd already made progress since 2018 in other local elections. What I haven't had time to look at and will be interesting to look at is have they succeeded, is the fact that they've gained seats on what is still a relatively modest average performance of around 11-12%, is that a reflection of an increasing success of concentrating their resources? And is there anywhere else where perhaps they can do a Brighton and begin to be able to get the concentration required to take a parliamentary seat? There wasn't much progress in that direction in 2019. I think, you know, it needs further looking at to see whether or not they're in that direction. But certainly the Greens were starting to eat into some of the vote amongst yes voters. And that's probably the reason why they were able to gain ground. But for most Green voters, the synergy between them and the SNP is one that they're quite comfortable with.
John, I think, has frozen, but we did get a lot of fantastic wisdom from John. So we'll leave it there with John. Thank you, John Curtis, who's frozen. I'll drop him a message afterwards to say thank you. But that was very, very brilliant. Just on that, just what I was, the point I was going to make, as I said, was in 2013, which is a midterm election, Labour got 29%, the Tories got 25%, and obviously 2 years later, that didn't bear any relation to the general election result. This is a midterm. Generally, what happens is voters can take a kind of guilt-free or risk-free punch at the government. So the fact that Labour only 2 points ahead, I think, raises questions. Just before I bring in our next two guests, thanks for watching, everyone. If you're watching live, I know a lot of you watch on Facebook, but do click through to the YouTube link and press like and subscribe. You can support us on Patreon. That keeps the show on the road, patreon.com/OwenJones84. You can suggest there are interviews. We've got our interview with Noam Chomsky, which I did on Friday, so we're going to put that up tomorrow. We've got interviews coming up with Judith Butler, Peter Hitchens, a very diverse range there. And we've got lots of documentaries coming. Now we're spending more time with the channel, which I've not been able to do for reasons I won't bore you with again. Obviously, the podcast, a lot of you listen, of course, on the podcast. So do listen to that on the podcast. You can just search Owen Jones podcast and then you can listen there, wherever you are. And you can use Super Chat like Peter O'Donovan, whose question I will put to the guests, and I will read you all out at the end. Right, let's bring in Paul, Mason and Michael Walker. Hi, guys.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you both?
Very well. Lovely day outside.
I know. I feel bad that you're... I'm going to a wedding, actually, in the Shard. That's probably going to destroy... I probably shouldn't have said that. Champagne socialist. Great. Here we go. It's a lovely day. Very sunny day, but...
It's only a lovely day in southern England. If this was the BBC, you would all get slaughtered now for because it's actually raining in the north of England. So all your north of England viewers are saying, basically.
I presume it's always raining back home, to be fair. Yeah. But yeah, I am a traitor to the north. I think we all know that already. Let's start on a point of unity. Let's just bash the Tories for a little bit before we talk about other stuff. Let's just bring up, I think, an interview which I think summed up so much about where the Conservatives currently are. And why they should be in a bigger mess than they are, frankly. Let's just have a look at this clip, which I think many people have seen from Good Morning Britain.
About a number of our viewers who have got in touch with us about the choices that they're making. Elsie is 77. She's a widow and she's a pensioner who lives in a council house. She receives a pension of £170 a week. Her energy bills have gone, get this, from £17 a month to £85 a month.
Yeah.
She will pay an additional £816 a year. To cut down on spending, Prime Minister, Elsie has now resorted to eating one meal a day. She's 77 years old. She's losing weight. She goes to the supermarket at the end of the day to buy yellow sticker discounted items. She gets up early in the morning to use her Freedom Bus Pass to stay on buses all day to avoid using energy at home. What else should Elsie cut back on, in your opinion?
Well, I don't want Elsie to cut back on anything. Let's talk about Elsie and what we're doing. And I just remind you that the 24-hour Freedom Bus Pass was something that I actually introduced, just parenthetically.
Marvellous. So Elsie should be grateful to you for her bus pass. But what else should...
What do you say? Well, it's something out of the darkest of satires, that, isn't it, really? I mean, presented with a case study of an elderly woman sitting on a bus to keep warm, and the Prime Minister says, well, actually, I introduced that Freedom Pass to allow her to do that. And he didn't even do that. He lied. Though, to be fair, I don't think he really understands the distinction between truth and lie, so maybe he doesn't know when he's lying. Yeah, Michael, just in terms of that, because we are, I think it's really important, because, you know, we will talk about Beergate, because we have to, but cost of living crisis is the defining issue of modern politics. The longest squeeze in living standards since the Napoleonic age, before the current squeeze. That's how bad. 2 decades of lost growth. We're going to go through 2 decades where people's wages are the same in real terms as they were when the crash happened. It's astonishing. So what do you make of that in terms of Boris Johnson, that response, and what it says about where the Conservatives are politically at the moment?
Well, I think what it means is that whoever is leader of the Labour Party in the next general election, they'll have a decent chance of winning. I wouldn't really write off anyone as Labour leader for potentially beating this Conservative Party in their current form. I mean, I was reading, it's very much an aside, but apparently the Conservative spin doctors are now trying to spin that event as Boris Johnson had food poisoning. So he actually had apparently a secret signal to say if he needed to rush off and puke. So if, you know, potentially we're supposed to be more forgiving of him for that performance than we otherwise would. I suppose it goes without saying that the Conservatives are just, I mean, very proactively, it seems, done nothing to resolve people's issues when it comes to the cost of living crisis. We've got inflation of 8%, benefits are going up by 3%. You've got Boris Johnson saying, oh, we couldn't possibly raise them because that would only further increase inflation. Nonsense. I mean, the inflation is driven by supply side issues. But at the same time, the idea that it is people on benefits or this 77-year-old woman, Elsie, who should be paying the price of that, you know, in his mind, to keep people's mortgage rates low, I don't think anyone is particularly buying. And it is why when Boris Johnson sort of, I saw him on Friday, I think, when he was talking about the election results, saying the message to us is, obviously, a completely boilerplate response. The message to us is we need to get on with the job and focus on the issues that matter to people, the people's priorities. And what are they? I mean, now he's got Brexit done, there is nothing I think the Conservatives are offering that anyone's going to want remotely. You know, there is a cost of living crisis and they're not offering anything, you know, at all. We can talk about whether Labour are doing enough, but I think, you know, they'll be happy with the fact that they've got this issue of the windfall tax on the energy companies sort of constantly being thrown at the Conservatives. I presume, I mean, I'm confident they could do more, but they could hardly do less than the Conservatives are doing right now.
I like the way you basically essentially just said that Boris Johnson shat himself on national television. Okay, fine. sorry.
That's his spin doctors. It wasn't from me.
Sure. They basically said he shat himself on national television. I'm sorry to be so crude on this lovely sunny Sunday afternoon. Paul, just what's your response to that?
Well, I think that the inflation that we've already seen, which is eroding our real living standards, is actually only half of what we're going to see by the end of the year. This new Bank of England prediction that we get 10% inflation and then minus a quarter of a percent GDP growth. I mean, that's stagflation. Hopefully, like all inflations, it peaks out because there are some one-offs. You know, it's the price spiking energy price because of the Ukraine war, spiking food prices. But those are realistic projections. And we haven't even seen that. Elsie hasn't even seen, I mean, she's gone, you know, from whatever it was, £17 a month to £85 a month. She could be looking at £150 a month. And that is, what does that mean? It doesn't mean that just elderly working class women on their own are going to be just panicking, to be honest, about how they're going to get from one month to the next. But you see it all the way up the value chain, you know, the sort of, we already, every one of us who lives in anywhere near a working class area sees young mums, you know, trying to, young parents, mainly young mums, trying to, you know, literally hovering at the end of the aisle where until the yellow stickers come on at 5 o'clock to get cheap food. Well, it's already a question of heating versus eating for them, and it might get worse. Meanwhile, you're 20, 30 somethings who at the moment, you know, that people in work, people who, you know, they're always looking forward to a pay rise. 10% inflation, unless you've got a very, very strong trade union like the RMT on steroids that can get you a 10% pay rise, it's a 10% pay cut, one off. And they're going to be looking at the end of the week at, you know, not going out. So all sections of society, it's not what they're feeling now, bad though that is, it's what they're going to be feeling when we hit that double-digit inflation plus recession. And I think that the task of politicians is actually to outline an answer to this. And I mean, Michael mentioned the windfall tax. The windfall tax raises £1 billion, £1.5 billion. It's nothing. The energy security problem for ordinary people and food security as well, just actually eating, is going to be such a huge problem that even Labour's, you know, the obvious red water they've put between themselves over, you know, windfall taxes and other measures won't be enough. We're going to have to look at, you know, and this is the problem for both Labour and the Tories. We just need radical fiscal intervention, you know, radical intervention with measures on the supply side, like price caps, like rent caps. Otherwise, I think there'll be really major discontent. And I'll just finish and say, obviously, we're all obsessed with elections. Yeah, I am. But I'm also interested in discontent. Discontent doesn't just express itself through elections. It expresses itself through riots. It expresses itself through, you know, civil unrest. And, I mean, nobody watching this programme, I think, I'm trying to think, 10% inflation. You know, I remember when the steelworkers got 20% pay rise in 1980. But does anybody know what 10% inflation feels like? I'm not sure.
So let's talk about Labour, shall we? Because I think we have different perspectives there. Now, we listen to the man, the great man, John Curtis. He is the preeminent philologist. I really can't say it. Let's have a look. Rejected vote share. So again, Labour 35%, Tories 33%. Now, if we again look at the councillors, Labour up 115. So the Tories lost. I mean, the Tories got battered. I think we really can say that. Minus 491, that's the lower end of what they feared. But Labour were not the principal beneficiaries there at all. And in fact, they didn't do much better than the Greens in terms of how many they gained. Michael, what's your response to what John's analysis was of where Labour... And the point he made was a lower percentage. Labour's vote share was actually slightly lower than 2018. And actually, the point he made about the North was those... Keir Starmer's thrown everything. That's his political strategy to win those areas back. So they've gone backwards compared to 2018.
Yeah, I mean, the graph that I saw, which seemed the most worrying for Labour, was showing how vote share had changed in different regions of the UK. And it was only in London that it increased, and everywhere else it had fallen since 2018. And I mean, I agree with John, that's what we should be comparing this to. I've heard people sort of say, oh, well, you can't. 2018, Labour had the red wall. So it doesn't matter if he's going back a little bit there, because that means he could still win back some of those seats. Well, saying we still had the red wall in 2018, I mean, I'm not sure that's particularly credible. It was in between an election where we held on to it by a thread and an election where we lost it incredibly dramatically. So I don't think you can say, oh, if we're performing like we did in 2018, that means we can win back those seats. I don't think anyone can be confident about that. Do these elections mean that Labour can't possibly become the largest party at the next general election? Absolutely not. I mean, I think that's perfectly plausible, perfectly possible. I suppose I was trying to think today, what would be, you know, if you're a real Keir Starmer stan, what would be your positive spin on this? And I've got it, which is that you could say the problem with Jeremy Corbyn was that he scared people. The problem with Keir Starmer is he doesn't excite anyone. So you could say that you might expect Keir Starmer to do better in a general election than in a local election because there are less people, you know, he can't infuse anyone during a low stakes election, but maybe he won't send people out to vote against him in a high stakes election. So potentially they could sort of say he's well placed to do better in a general than Jeremy Corbyn, but it's not a high... It's not looking good for someone who has rested their whole identity as Labour leader on I am someone who can win. Like I've seen today sort of tweets saying, you know, Keir Starmer said, well, we shouldn't talk about Beergate. We should talk about the real issues that are facing the country right now. And we should talk about my big ideas. Mm-hmm. What are your big ideas? You know, what are the real issues facing the country? So if all you can say is say, I'm electable and I'm an upstanding citizen. Mm-hmm. If your election results aren't particularly good, and now you're being investigated by the police, you're going to need something else to run on.
We'll come on to that because it's a really critical point. Paul, I mean, I just want to put to you that the expectations management by the Labour leadership was an exercise in epic gaslighting, because the whole thing was 2018's results were so good. Who's Labour leader at the time? Oh, it was Jeremy Corbyn. That because of Long Corbyn, that we'll struggle to do as well as we did under Jeremy Corbyn because of Long Corbyn. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It's completely inconsistent. And what it does show, do you not think? Their whole shtick, the revisionism of Labour history, is 2017 was just a blip. It was an aberration. Theresa May fucked it. And that's why Labour did well. And actually, 2018 showed they sustained that, didn't they? It wasn't a blip. Yeah. So do you not accept it's epic gaslighting, the Labour leadership's expectation management?
I mean, I tend to just ignore expectation management anyway. I mean, I think part of it is true. That is that... The part of it that is true is that it is, you know, there it was a high point and they needed to go beyond it. The whole Long Corbyn thing is, I think, part of that is true, but it's not the reason why they're not going. That's not the reason why they're not going forward. I'll come to why I think it is. I think what I do take issue with John Curtis. I mean, cephalology is, as he said, it's the study of pebbles. It's the study of literally how many stones were thrown on this side and on the other. There are other ways of understanding electoral dynamics. One of them is MRP polling, which I'm a bigger fan of. And MRP polling, that is, you look at the demographics of certain areas and you dig into them. No, I haven't done it. I don't do it. But in a kind of intuitive way, I'm just looking at a couple of places. Lee, where I come from, Labour was winning wards that were quite Brexity. In Lee, a lot of the Brexity wards are where miners used to live. And they were winning. And also where they weren't winning, they were quite close. That's one thing. Nuneaton, where they went backwards, again, it was really interesting little microcosm in Nuneaton. Lots and lots of places where the difference, where if you add the Labour and the Green vote, Labour would either just have won or just have lost. So for me, I take the positives that there is a direction of travel, even within parts of the Red Wall. The problem is Red Wall it's not a homogeneous thing. If you look at places like Mansfield, places like Amber Valley, there is a cultural difference. Like Ratcliffe, I was told that Labour pulled its campaigning teams from Ratcliffe, which is an area in Bury. And those who know it, and you know and love it, it's like got a hegemonic Gramscian party called Ratcliffe Independents. And they scooped the pool. They won everything. And that's because, I mean, they're not primarily Brexity, but it's a bit Brexity, that party. Now, what we can say, the huge positives are the London councils. And again, you know, as someone who's interested in the dynamics of class struggle rather than elections, I see those London council results as part of the continuing radicalisation, not just of London, but of the urban proletariat. You know, I mean, yeah. Seeing Bristol, Worthing, you know, everywhere where there is sort of university educated people and a salariat, Labour is really doing well. Mm-hmm. So I still agree that they're nowhere near being able to form a majority government. But as Curtis said, that might not be what the next election is about.
Let's talk about Beergate. Now, I have to say, I was one of those people who basically dismissed that out of hand as a right-wing desperate attempt to deflect from Partygate, which obviously engulfed the government with pretty politically disastrous consequences. And I feel like an idiot now, to be honest. And I think this is actually quite revealing, partly because actually Labour bet the house on this, because Labour's whole shtick under Starmer was, we're going to be, the dividing lines are integrity, honesty, you know, it's a test of character almost, rather than having transformative policies to deal with the cost of living crisis. Now, let's just quickly go through why I'm an idiot, basically. Let's just see what the latest Keir Starmer interview is doing this.
As I've explained a number of times, I was working in the office. We stopped for something to eat. There was no party. There was no breach of the rules. I'm confident about that. Police have obviously got to do their job. But meanwhile, I'm here in Scotland because we've had a fantastic set of results, the best results for 10 years, coming second in Scotland. There's a smile on all of our faces, and we've taken this council. So Labour is very clearly back on the pitch, and we're turning the corner, and now we're marching towards that general election.
Yeah. Dear me. So basically, the reason I feel like a complete idiot, I thought we had the ops note, but an ops note has been published, which shows very clearly that this was a pre-planned dinner, which was planned for 1 hour 20 minutes. A staffer is briefing. I know people be like, oh, they're briefing the right-wing media. Fine, I'm fine for people to say that, to be honest with you, but nonetheless, a staffer is briefing that no work was done afterwards. Now, what Keir Starmer, the reason I defended him is in interviews he kept saying that we were working and then we stopped very briefly to have some food and carry.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
carried on. Now, what Joe Mourne, the lawyer, Meek will be, we've interviewed him on the show several times. First, whether or not you think the investigation is politically motivated, I think there were proper questions which arise for Starmer's team. And it seems he says plainly right, Durham Police should investigate them. That they should, he says, investigate Cummings, but two wrongs don't make a right. And he said he really wouldn't want to be placing a bet that Starmer hasn't broken the law. So he thinks it's entirely possible that he's broken the law. Why is this important? Well, I mean, Rishi Sunak, let's be honest, Rishi Sunak's political career was destroyed by turning up to a meeting early to have, and he didn't know there was going to be a birthday and having some birthday cake. If we're going to be honest, that's what happened. But you see, Labour went for him on that viciously and aggressively and succeeded in scalping him. Now, if you've got the Labour leadership who went so hard on this, and it's clear that they had, when they were campaigning, they had a social event indoors, not with people in their own bubble, which is what the law allowed for at the time, and they didn't work, which is what staffers are briefing the newspapers. Well, he's cocked, isn't he?
Owen, it's one staffer, and you're wrong. The operations note proves that it was a work event. Because work.
Why does it prove it's a work event if they're having it? What? It allowed for social events for people outside of.
It says nothing to do with but a social event. Mary Foy was there as part of the event. One, and two, that work stops at the end of the day after the dinner. That would, to me, prove that number one, that it was a work event, and I think that's the reason that Yes, the Tories have managed to knock Labour off the news cycle the agenda they wanted. Yes. It's given some ammunition to the right-wing press, and it is, of course, a right-wing.
Paul, this is what the Tories. You're literally regurgitating what the Tories said about their events. You're saying the same thing they did.
I don't care because the point is, Keir hasn't broken the law.
How do you know that? Why does Julian Mourne think they might have broken the law when he's a lawyer and you don't?
Julian Mourne's Twitter thing starts with the thing, I don't know much about this, okay?
No, he didn't say that. He didn't say that. He said he had...
Let's not have an argument about him. Have an argument about Keir. It's quite clear that they didn't break the law because it was a work event, number one. Okay. This source briefing the Times, very interesting, isn't it? One source doesn't brief that Keir broke the law at all. This source has a grudge against Mary Foy, okay? And for people in the Labour movement, that might give you you don't want a jigsaw identifier.
Well, I don't think we're going to do a character assassination now on someone we don't know anything about.
I'm going to do a character assassination of a source who's not been revealed.
Well, I know. We can't. We don't know who he is, do that.
But the Times said. The Times reported that the mail was being held by people or a person who was from the left and didn't like Starmer. Fine. Well, the police will take that into account. I think Starmer will come out of this with increased moral authority. He'll be proved innocent. And so that's my prediction.
Maybe he will. Yeah. Michael.
So why would we, the left, join in some kind of Tory-initiated right-wing pylon that's only there to distract from the issue of cost of living and all the other fuck-ups that they're doing?
Michael, are we essentially by being Tory stooges by indulging this? And do you think Keir Starmer has been honest?
I think it depends what you do. So I was thinking about the difference between sort of what some on the left are doing now vis-a-vis Starmer and what some on the right did vis-a-vis Jeremy Corbyn. And I do think, if I were to get a spot on Question Time this week or whatever, I wouldn't have a question thrown at me about whether Keir Starmer would be a good prime minister when it comes to the economy and say, no, this guy's dishonest because he potentially lied about some curry he had in Durham once. And that was the kind of thing that the right were doing to Jeremy Corbyn. There was different issues of the day, and they were booking their 8:10 p.m., their 8 a.m. slot on the Today programme to trash him and say, the real issue here is anti-Semitism, blah, 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 blah. If there was anyone on the left who was doing that, it was sort of like hogging the camera to make every sort of potential good news story for Labour one about Keir Starmer having a curry and a beer in Durham in 2021. I do think that would be a problem. And I do think you could very reasonably say you're doing the Tories' job for them in the same way that Margaret Hodge was doing the Tories' job for them back in 2019. I think it's a very different story when you've got people who are essentially just doing commentary on Twitter and are refusing to fall in line with and do Starmer's job for him, essentially. Because for me, the issue here is I'm not a lawyer, right? I don't know if the law was broken. My understanding is the question isn't just, was it a work event? It's, was it an event which was reasonably necessary for work? And so the argument which Julian Mourne is putting forward, and he's a lawyer, I'm not a lawyer, he's saying all the facts that I can see in front of me, this it looks like this is probably not reasonably necessary for work. There are other, you know, QCs. I've seen Adam Wagner do a thread where he's saying, no, potentially this was reasonably necessary for work. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I haven't pored over the regulations. But I think what seems to me to be the case is that there's a high chance, you know, a non-negligible chance that Keir Starmer gets a fine from this. And I do think if he gets a fine from this, he's going to have to resign. And yeah. And that's not...
Well, David Bowers asked this, yeah. Do you think Starmer will resign?
That's not because what he's done is morally equivalent to Boris Johnson. I think we should be absolutely clear. Boris Johnson's fine was an indication that he'd taken part in a pattern of behaviour which was deeply offensive to anyone who'd suffered during COVID-19. Keir Starmer hasn't done that. But what Keir Starmer has done is stood up and said, because Boris Johnson is being investigated by the police, he should resign. Now, the defence there is, oh, he was talking within a context of Boris Johnson having broken all of these laws and it being horrendous. Fair enough. I think, you know, it's awkward for him, but I think you can plausibly make that case. The Rishi Sunak thing one, I don't, because Rishi Sunak did just turn up to a meeting a bit early. There was a birthday cake, right? It wasn't particularly offensive to the victims of COVID-19, but he got fined and Keir Starmer said, that's enough that you should resign. If Keir Starmer now gets fined in an event, which I agree, I don't find particularly offensive. You know, I don't think that was an FU to the victims of COVID. But if he gets fined and he's called for Rishi Sunak to resign over exactly the same thing, I don't see how he can maintain his position as leader of the Labour Party without becoming a national object of ridicule.
I mean, that's true, isn't it, Paul? David Bowers says, if he doesn't resign, what damage will his hypocrisy do to the party?
I think, like I say, I don't think he's going to be found guilty. And one, I don't think he's going to be found in breach of the law. Two, the Durham police do not issue retrospective fines, because if they did, they'd have to fine Dominic Cummings as well. So again, if it were me, here's what I say. I'm a class fighter. You know, I see this as a complete setup job by the right-wing media to distract from the fact that that Labour is actually advancing, that the Tories are in trouble. And so if it were me, one option would be to say, yes, of course, we did call for all these people to resign. If the Durham police have been bounced into a investigation by a bunch of false information and then found me guilty, and then revived, making me the only person that they've ever retrospectively fined, I see that as a political attack, as political policing, and I would fight back. No, I don't think it's.
That's exactly the same as the Metropolitan Police and Rishi Sunak, though. No, I mean they weren't going. They initially said we're not going to do a retrospective investigation.
But Labour is not responsible for the Metropolitan Police. It's not responsible for the timing or the decision when they decided to.
They backed it. They said this is a great thing and they should resign because the investigation is open.
Paul, just quickly, the Tories suggested that the Metropolitan Police had been bounced into doing their investigation by political pressure.
Hold on a minute. The Sue Gray report, which originated as the Cabinet Secretary's report, i.e. the investigation, was already underway. So The point is that there was a pattern of proven law-breaking, unproven, self-admitted, Allegra Stratton, one. Two, there's an investigation going on into it, and in many ways the Met intervention puts the stymie on that investigation. I still think that investigation would be what finishes Johnson. Three, Johnson then lied to Parliament, which is something that Starmer hasn't done. And so what we must be really careful about is not erecting moral equivalences between these things when he hasn't even been found guilty and can't be fined and without a major act of political policing.
Let's move on from that. I mean, in a sense, Beergate, for me, I'm not that personally invested, as I've already said. And I think the point that you make about lying, I think this is really important, and I think we need to get to this point. And it's not a discussion that the media has had for very fascinating reasons. Boris Johnson is an epic liar. I mean, lying is woven into the very fabric of his being. His whole political career is based on deceit. And as I said, I don't think he knows the difference between truth or lies himself, though I'll spare everyone the cod psychology. But that doesn't mean Keir Starmer isn't himself a fundamentally dishonest politician, because he is, isn't he, Paul? His whole leadership campaign, and I think we need to talk about this because I think it's about where Labour goes from here, is the most dishonest leadership campaign in the history of British democracy. No leader has ever stood for leadership of their party and won and marched so dramatically in the opposite direction. Tony Blair didn't say he was going to revise Clause 4 when he stood for leader, but he damn well made clear which direction his leadership was going to go in. Now, what Starmer did is he said he was going to be basically Corbynism without Corbyn. And what he's offering now is Blairism without Blair and indeed the charisma. And I'm just interested in this, Paul, because I'm not saying this to have a go, because I just think this is where we go from here. Just in terms of what you said at the time, because I think this is a discussion we never had. And I, you know, John Maynard Keynes said, when the facts change, I change my views. What do you do, sir? And I've had to be held account for things I've got very wrong, as everyone knows. This is what you said in the leadership campaign, and I want to see if you've changed your opinion, okay? So you said, if you don't think Keir Starmer would advance the class struggle, you're possibly not understanding social democracy correctly from a Marxist perspective. You said that Keir is firmly on the left, albeit a different left than the Corbyn-McDonald tradition. I think we can all agree on that. He will stick by the economic radicalism of 2015 to 2019, above all, Green New Deal, rejecting austerity and fighting for a new economic model. And you also... Oh, that's the same one. But you also, so you said very clearly at the time that he was and you said, sorry, the other tweet that I don't have is that he was not going to purge the left. Yep. Now, in the Sunday Times last week, Keir Starmer hints expulsion for Labour's NATO skeptic MPs. And that is within Keir Starmer's office, his advisors, who are all a bunch of Blairites now, because all the lefties that they kept for the leadership campaign in order to dupe people on the left into voting Keir Starmer, they're gone. They've been basically lost by attrition. He is intellectually, apparently, sold on kicking out 11 left-wing MPs. And I predicted last year, with you both here, that they would do this, because that they would end up saying, we'll end up relying on these left-wing MPs in a hung parliament, and they don't want to do that, so they'll kick them out. And they're already talking about doing that. Isn't it just the case, Paul? You got this one wrong. Keir Starmer, whatever is going on in his head... His project is a new Labour revanchist project. It's the hard right of the Labour Party, and they want the left permanently buried and exiled. And their economic programme, such as it is a tinkering around the edges, which is why they went on hard on Partygate, because they don't have any transformative policies.
So that's a long list of things. I think the first thing is to come back to your original point. Is he a fundamentally dishonest politician? No. I don't think so. I think he's true to his values. I know what his values are. I described them at the time in all the stuff that I've written. They are basically left Rawlsian liberalism. He is a Rawlsian liberal in the sense that he believes in social justice and the state as a way to deliver it. That's basically what it is. Now, let's come to bit by bit through this. Okay, so what did I get wrong? Did I get things wrong? First of all, from a Marxist viewpoint, was a wind-up to this. I don't want to use pejorative terms about people, but someone who is not in touch with reality, called Joshua Y. Jackson. And if you look at it, it's a reply, right? It's not a tweet saying it's a reply to this guy's mania. Let's take the things he's done. I'm not going to defend everything about what he's done, but one thing that he and Rachel Reeves, who's more to the right of Labour than he is, have done is deliver a Green New Deal style fiscal offer, the 28 billion a year. That's a big thing, and it was something that was fought for inside Labour, and I think it gives us on the left a shell of money which we can fill with radical proposals. That's one thing. The purging of the left. Let's move to that. Okay, what did he do wrong? First of all, he took a series of stupid and needless whipping decisions that forced people like Nadia Whittam and Olivia Blake and all the rest of them out of the shadow, out of their front bench roles, you know, their PPS roles, and some shadow cabinet ministers. And then number two, I think the way he handled the Rebecca Long Bailey thing was needless, and another example of trying to push Corbynites out. That's another thing. So I disagree fundamentally with the way he has handled the left. As to whether it's Keir who's pushing for those 11 MPs to go, I'd say probably not. I think not.
He was definitely not going to purge the left, Paul, in the leadership.
Wait a minute. On the specifics. It's more people to the right of him. Indeed, you know, the people who are pushing for the 11. Remember that those 11, I think, got duped into signing an absolutely disgraceful petition. I've heard other left MPs say will probably end their careers full stop. Because how can you trust them if you are a anti-NATO, pro-Putin leftist? How could you ever trust them ever again? So, but that's, but I don't want them. I want them to be in. I want them to stop signing Stop the War petitions and become a far more vibrant left. Number one, I think the left has walked into a bunch of purges, to be honest. When we talk about purging the left, you know, people who, you know, it's almost as if they stand up and sort of arms spread, shout, shoot me now, by tweeting stuff that they know is going to get them expelled. I think that's for them to decide. In the end, I think there is too much discipline. There is too much use of disciplinaries. I'm certainly against the prescription of workers' liberty. I'm certainly against the prescriptions of some of the other groups. And yeah, we are at war for democracy. But, you know, remember, it's not just Keir. There's a right wing to the right of him that's lining up to get rid of him. And I think, like some of the people on the left today, they would be highly delighted if he had to resign as a result of Beergate, because they're lining up all, and raising funds already.
So, Michael, we're going to run out of time. So, Michael, what's No, it's fine. I asked a very long, rambling question. Michael, in terms of just the honesty of Keir Starmer, because, I mean, the argument I would say is, it's, you know, the media, I would say, let him get off the hook for the most, as I said, dishonest leadership campaign in the history of British democracy. If people can find a more dishonest leadership campaign, I'd love to hear it. But and they, because the those on the receiving end were the left, and we're not legitimate political actors. You can do what you want to the left. That's fine. That's how British politics works. But now they're trying to do him over on potentially a much, much smaller dishonesty, aren't they? So what's your just response to what what Paul said, and about the honesty of Keir Starmer?
I mean, I suppose we can talk about honesty. I mean, I think his honesty speaks for itself. He will say one thing one day and say another thing the other. I agree with what you've said, that the media don't care about the leadership election being a scam because they don't see that the left as legitimate political actors. Potentially now, because he's made truthfulness and integrity sort of the only thing he stands for, you know, it would be a pretty ridiculous reason to have to resign as leader of the Labour Party for having a curry and a beer. But, you know, I wouldn't shed a tear for him. I suppose the thing I want to push back on, just because I feel like it's an important thing to say given who's going to be watching this show, is I do think it's pretty not cool, essentially, to say that the people who've been expelled from the Labour Party basically waved a flag and said, please expel me. Now, I don't know all of the cases. I'm sure we could go through all of the various ones, and there are different things we could disagree about. But the one that sort of stands out to me most is Pamela Fitzpatrick. She was sort of like a very impressive campaigner for welfare rights. I remember going campaigning for her with my mum, who also worked in welfare rights. She was like,
I campaigned for
brilliant.
Well,
yeah. She started the Harrow Law Centre, stood to be General Secretary of the Labour Party, exactly the kind of person who you want to be sitting on the Labour benches. She gets expelled for having a meeting once with Socialist Action before Socialist Action were prescribed. Now, if your response to that is to say, well, she probably asked for it,
Socialist
I do think you've potentially lost your way a little bit. And I think it is an issue of respect. I think fair enough to say, look, a few unjust suspensions, if what they're going to do is 28 billion a year in a Green New Deal, like, we can disagree about how plausible that is. But I think, fine, it's fair enough to say he's done these bad things, but I want this money invested into the green economy. But to sort of turn around and say, if you've been expelled from the Labour Party in the past 2 years, you probably asked for it, I think is not really, you shouldn't really let it pass.
No, I'm not saying that of everybody, but there are some, and they are the lowest ones. Pamela Fitzpatrick, I take the point. There are others. Again, all the retrospective justice. What I would prefer is to bring in natural and indeed legal justice to the Labour Party. This is why the rule change they're bringing in is so pernicious. They're trying to get natural justice out of the Labour Party. I think we should all have a right to sue for our ability to be members. I think what the investigations into JVL have been a disaster as well. So I'm not trying to defend the purges. I'm against them. I'll fight against them on an individual basis. But I mean, pragmatically,
unless someone signed a petition against NATO, potentially.
No, look, that what I'd say about that is that it's not signing a petition against NATO. It's signing a petition blaming NATO for a war on the eve of which a guy invades and starts genociding the Ukrainian people. You can, if you think it's going to be fun going on the doorstep with an MP who's done that, then it'll be much worse than what it was in parts of the Midlands with Corbyn. It's just going to be awful. And I think that I would question the judgment of everybody who did it. I don't want to expel them. I want to hear from them what they've learned, actually. For me, the most important thing that happens in the world is this horrific conflict. And getting it so badly wrong as a Labour MP And by the way, we're not just dealing with left people. We're dealing with people on the Tory right. We're dealing with Labour MPs who turn out to have taken £500,000 from China.
I mean, I have to say, but isn't that just quickly? It's a double standard, isn't it? I mean, Labour MPs have gone to Saudi Arabia, paid for by the Saudi regime. They shill for the Saudi dictatorship as it carpet bombs Yemen. They support the Turkish regime. I mean, this is hypocrisy, though, isn't it? The standards.
Well, the one who supported the Turkish regime is now a Tory peer, isn't he? So it kind
good
of
point. Good point. Yeah.
And you've got a Labour leader who says, "Oh, Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem." And well, Amnesty International all say Israel is apartheid. I disagree with them. Actually, it's a beacon of democracy. Now, I don't want to go on a doorstep with that guy, but you know,
well,
can you make disciplinary decisions based on that? Well, but that was your argument for why someone signing NATO letter you disagree with should be kicked out of the party.
Yeah,
where are you drawing the line? Why are you drawing the line exactly where the right wing press do? Essentially, is what I'm asking.
Well, it's not just where the right-wing press would do. I think it's where any decent socialist would do.
But why would they draw it there and not apartheid Israel? That's what I'm saying.
The Labour Party has a strong Zionist tradition. In fact, a mainstream Zionist tradition, and always has had. I'm not a Zionist.
Zionism or not. It's about, do you recognise the systematic violation of human rights? You can be a Zionist and still think Israel is an apartheid state.
Yeah, there are Zionists who think that.
No, absolutely. Yeah. So why the difference? Because Ukraine is a war which has just started and is killing. So, I'm sorry.
The occupation of Palestine
You're telling me that anybody who supports the state of Israel is that's what you're saying?
No, that's not what I'm saying. Should not be going on the doorstep for Labour.
Be very careful.
No.
Be very careful with that.
No one has said that remotely, Paul. So the issue we're making is, so you're saying that NATO potentially provoked Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
No, they didn't say potentially. They said NATO was responsible.
Let's start. So saying NATO provoked the war in Ukraine, which I think there's some truth to. I mean, I don't think that letter was particularly well drafted, but signing it is not a red line for me. And if it were, I think I'd find it very difficult to justify it being a red line for me, and it not be a red line for me that Keir Starmer not said, I believe there should be a state of Israel. He has said that these three of the leading human rights organizations in the world have come out, one of them Israeli, and have said that Israel is an apartheid state because it does these different things. He said, no, I don't agree with that. No, I think boycott, divest and sanctions would be terrible. And that, while I accept you disagree with him there, you disagree with him on that, but you think that's perfectly reasonable and he should be leader of the Labour Party. A backbencher signed something about NATO that you disagree with and you think that they should be expelled. And what I find interesting is that the only explanation I can find for drawing that line, but not that line, is that one of them is seen as acceptable by the political establishment, by Keir Starmer and mainstream press.
This is the Putin talking point, isn't it? Supporting Ukraine is racist. You know, everybody who supports Ukraine is really doing it because they don't support Yemen, because they don't support Palestine.
This is not remotely what I've said in any way whatsoever.
That is the logic behind the point you're making.
Paul, can I just quickly sum up what Michael is saying here? He's saying, if you're going to say that people who suggested NATO expansion played a role in the invasion of Ukraine, they shouldn't be in the Labour Party. We're not talking about people supporting the state of Israel. There are lots. Jeremy Corbyn supports the two-state solution. You could lump him in that. Okay, we're not talking about people about supporting the right of the state of Israel to exist.
Yeah.
That's not the discussion we're having. It's about Israel being described as an apartheid state
I would describe it as an apartheid state.
But the point that Michael is making is, why should it be possible for it to be perfectly permissible and acceptable and legitimate to deny the apartheid regime that does exist in Israel, according to Amnesty, Human Rights Watch and B'Tselem, and that's fine to be in the Labour Party, but if you say the wrong thing about Ukraine, you're out. Why? What's the difference?
There's a difference.
There's
a difference. It's not saying the wrong thing about Ukraine.
I think it's wrong, by the way. I don't, by the way, I think Russia is ruled by a despicable, kleptocratic, gangster, chauvinist regime, and de-Ukrainization, all the rhetoric that they have, makes it very clear where they stand. But Israel is an apartheid state. Yes. And the leader of the Labour Party quoted a racist quote by Harold Wilson, I have to say, about how Palestine was a, what did he say? It was like a desert where nothing was there.
They made the desert bloom because Arabs can't grow things.
That was racist, blatant racism. So why is it possible for Keir Starmer to deny the apartheid nature, which Amnesty and Human Rights Watch and Bet Salem say it is, and that's fine and acceptable, but you're beyond the pale on Ukraine for the reasons you've described. Why?
Well, okay, just let me explain it to you. It is entirely legitimate within the Labour Party for there to be a range of opinions on Israel, which I would not share, okay, which A, massively support Israel, you know, everything it does, criticize it in its own terms. Keir's position I wouldn't share, right the way through to an anti-Zionist position that I think non-Zionist position that many of the left would put, and certainly all the Jewish Voice for Labour people who are still in the party.
Who they want to purge.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, okay. But that's entirely, I want to fight for a party where it's legitimate remember what I said before, it's mainstream tradition of the Labour Party has been to support Israel. That's been its mainstream. If you want a party that has never supported it and does not, okay, that's going to be a different party. So here's a contrast, right? A range of opinions, an alliance of people around progressive goals can have different opinions on Israel. They cannot have different opinions on a genocidal war being perpetrated against a people in their thousands.
Just quickly, Paul, because I've got to go to a wedding and I'm going to get killed if I don't finish the stream as a result. But just quickly, do you think that all Labour figures who support arming Saudi Arabia, who are on record supporting arming Saudi Arabia as it carpet bombs Yemen, I'm including people who've supported selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, like Luke Akers, who sits on the National Executive Committee. And I also mean dozens, and we're talking dozens of Labour MPs who voted in 2016. They defied the whip when Jeremy Corbyn put down a motion, or they can't remember, the motion was on arming Saudi Arabia. Do you think they should be kicked out of the Labour Party? If you support
Are you do then, Owen? Are you saying Luke Akers should be kicked out of the Labour Party?
No, I'm not. You're the one who's saying people should be kicked out of the Labour Party.
So I am making a difference.
What's the difference? Yemen's the worst humanitarian crisis on earth. They are murdering children in buses with bombs from Britain.
Some understanding here. There are many differences that are containable within the Labour Party. But for me, the difference that says NATO is the aggressor in the Ukraine crisis is not containable. Because Russia is waging a genocidal war.
Right. Okay. Why?
So that's my politics. That's my opinion.
Why is the life of a Yemeni so much lower than that of a Ukrainian?
Go again. So, Owen, this is the Putin talking point.
No. Supporting what? Ukraine is racist. How dare you?
Supporting Ukraine is racist. Raising Ukraine above brown people. That's the Putin talking point.
I support Ukraine's just war of liberation against Russian aggression. I support arming Ukraine against Russian aggression. Okay. On Yemen, where I've been to a Yemeni refugee camp, I've met Yemeni refugee children who drew pictures of their homes being bombed.
So you were asking me what's the difference? There is no difference between the life of a Ukrainian. There's no difference.
So I'm asking you, why don't you support booting out Labour MPs who support arming, a head chopping, a dictatorship that beheads people like myself for being gay and Michael, that brutalizes women, that exports international extremism and carpet bombs Yemen? Why are those people in the broad church of the Labour Party legitimate political actors and the people you're describing in Ukraine aren't? Why?
It's sad that they exist. It's sad that they have that position. I don't know how many of them there actually are.
Dozens.
Dozens. Right. Okay. It's sad, but it's not the same. Okay, it's not the same.
Why?
We, Labour, are a party whose commitment to NATO is unshakable. It's non-negotiable.
But whatever, but what's that got to do with this? What's it got to do with the value of life? It's a military organisation. The sanctity of NATO is more important than anything else.
The value of all lives are equal for me.
Good. I'm glad we established it.
Okay, so
Labour tradition values some lives more than other, and we have to be bound by Labour tradition.
No, that's nothing to do with Labour tradition. NATO, Labour's tradition on NATO is that we're part of NATO, and you cannot go on the doorstep with people who have wrongly and falsely, you know, echoed the propaganda talking points of a guy who has unleashed a genocidal war.
Right,
we
all
can go on the doorstep with people who have not just echoed the talking points of the leaders of Saudi Arabia, but have actively gone there and supported sending the precise wars which are killing people
in
Yemen.
That's the party you joined. I mean, sorry,
I've been in it. There's only two parties in it. There's one party that can get into government. If your argument is you have to accept that in this party, nothing is about righteousness, nothing is about justice. What it is about is these are the set parameters of the party. It's a party that supported colonialism quite recently. It's a party that went to the war in Iraq very recently. And so what we're going to do is when we're assessing who should be in it and who should not be in it, we're saying, is your relationship to foreign policy within the Labour tradition, and the Labour tradition being an incredibly imperialist and one which doesn't value lives equally. So I don't see how you can both say lives should be valued equally and we're going to let our sort of compassion towards people be sort of limited within that which has been valued within the Labour tradition. It just doesn't make any moral sense.
So it makes a lot of moral sense to me, but we're going around in circles. To me, I don't want Stalinism to be part of the Labour tradition. That's my position. I don't want... See, there was a communist
party. You want Saudi apologism to be acceptable within the Labour tradition?
There was a communist party in the 1930s. It signed a pact. It advocated a pact with Hitler.
Why is it relevant?
It's got nothing to do with the Labour tradition. It would be much better for me, from my point of view, if we had an internationalist left, an internationalist centre, but having a Stalinist left that continually pollutes the image and perception of being left with its support for this guy in Moscow is
not functional. Even supporting the, I mean, anyway,
no, I need to go to a wedding.
Yeah, I think we should all. Yeah, but I mean, we're not going to agree on it. But
no, well, apparently, as I've said, if you're an apologist for a head chopping regime which carpet bombs children, by the way, who including children on a bus on the way back from a picnic,
I know how bad they are. I know how bad they are.
But they're fine in the Labour Party. The glorious.
It's not a question of fine. It's a question of what is social democracy and what are its basic and moral and political tenets.
Child murderers, apparently. Anyway, look, we need to end there. I've enjoyed this, by the way. It's good to have a passionate discussion. And it has been great. And I think you've both been very eloquently put your cases. So I really appreciate both of you. I've known you both for a very long time. And it's lovely to have you here. Go and get some sun. I know lots of people don't have sun. I looked up Stockport's weather, where I'm from. Cloudy. So I apologize to the people of my hometown for suggesting this is a glorious sunny day when it isn't in many parts of the world. All right. Lots of love, everyone. Really enjoyed it. And take care of yourself. Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you found that informative, educational, interesting. And I certainly did. Do support us on Patreon to keep the show on the road. /OwenJones84. Leave us some stars. That'd be nice. Spread the word. And I look forward to speaking to you soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.